We're going to talk today about Judaism, but we're going to talk specifically about kind of modern-day Judaism, post-Holocaust Judaism, because we could talk about Judaism. Judaism has a long history, and the practices changed over time, because you're talking about a religion that's been in existence for more than 5,000 years. Obviously, things changed over time. So we're eventually going to, we're going to really focus today on kind of Judaism as it's practiced today. But what I want to be clear about is that Judaism as it's practiced today is very different than Judaism as it was practiced at the time of Jesus, for the major reason that there is no longer a temple. All right, and there hasn't been since about 70 AD. And it's the time of year, so I kind of want to put this on the record, where you'll see lots of Christian churches doing we're doing a Seder. And they take the modern Passover Seder and say, well, this is what Jesus did. Well, no. The modern Passover Seder bears very little resemblance to the Passover as Jesus would have celebrated it. I get this question a couple of times every other year, and so I just kind of want to put on the record, the reason we don't do a Seder here is that it's not appropriate to take someone else's religious practice and play act it in your denomination. We would be really upset if the Muslim temple took our Eucharistic prayer and had their imam lead it. And it's the same thing. And also, the Seder, as it's practiced today, is not the Last Supper meal that Jesus would have had. It would have been a Passover celebration meal, a Passover meal that he was at. But you're talking about two very different things. And the reason that they're two very different things is that, as I said, up until 70 AD, there was a temple in Jerusalem. And so people who kept the Passover mostly went to Jerusalem and offered their sacrifice in Jerusalem, or if they couldn't make it to Jerusalem, did their Passover meal as if they had been to Jerusalem and offered their sacrifice. After 70 AD, the temple is destroyed, and the Jewish people are scattered. And this is what is called the diaspora, all right? The Jewish people were dispersed from Jerusalem, from Galilee, from Judea, from that area into the world, right? A lot of them ended up in Egypt and then over North Africa and came up into Spain along with the spread of Islam, but also on their own. Others of them went into Italy and then up into what is today Eastern Europe, Germany and Poland and those areas, and on into Russia. All right, so you have those two very different paths. But what happened is, because they were dispersed and because there was no longer a temple and was not going to be a temple in the foreseeable future, Judaism at that point really changed and became a very home-based faith, so that most of the Jewish practices took place in and around the home or in a small group, a place where 12 men could gather, and that's called a minyan. And don't ask me how to spell it, because it is different ways in different places. But basically, if you had 12 men, you had the minimum number for all kinds of rituals. And so you would have a rabbi who gathered a small community around them, because people are on the move for a while. And wherever they go, they're outsiders. And like most outsiders, they become the scapegoat and often have to move on. And if you've seen, just to give one example, Fiddler on the Roof, you have seen what this is like, right? Oh, look, we're having economic problems. Well, let's blame them and force them on. So the religion becomes very focused on the home and on small communities. So the Passover Seder, where we celebrate the Passover solely in the home around a home table, develops. And the Sabbath prayers, where they happen at the family dinner table on the Sabbath, develop. And so the practices become very, very centered on home and on small communities.
What's the main reason for that? For the Seder itself?
For the Seder itself? Because it is one of the principal feasts. The Passover remembers the freedom from slavery in Egypt, right? The passing over of the angel of death. That's where the word comes from. And God commands the people of Israel to remember it every year. And so they do. Now, the modern Passover Seder has components to it, in addition to a roast meat that you share with your neighbors, which was the original command, and unleavened bread. It has bitter herbs to remind people of slavery in Egypt that you dip in salt water, and a sweet combination of cinnamon and apples and nuts that is sweet, but is also supposed to look like the mortar of bricks, because when they were slaves in Egypt, they did a lot of building. It's all to remind them of the great works that God has done.
Isn't there a deviled egg in there?
There's an egg in there, and there's a bone in there, and those are post-temple. The bone represents the sacrifice that would have been made, and then the hard-boiled egg represents life, just like it does for us on Easter, represents new life.
After the chicken.
Yes, well, you know.
But Jews were never instructed to share their faith with outsiders, were they? But Christians...
That's not necessarily true. There are periods in Jewish history where Judaism is very evangelistic, where they share their faith and bring people in. There are periods where they absolutely aren't. And... The periods where they shared their faith...
this would be with Gentiles.
Yes.
Okay.
Kind of right after the establishment of the nation of Israel, mm-hmm. they were a very evangelistic faith. And then another period of time, just after, during the reign of Solomon, they become a very evangelistic faith and welcome people in a lot. But... as they become more and more the outsiders, they do what outsider groups do, and they close themselves off. And so that now there's a rule that if you come to a rabbi and say you want to convert to Judaism, he has to turn you away 3 times. And if you still keep coming back, then he can teach you.
Hmm.
And that a lot of that comes from being the outsider. And when you're an outsider, you... look with suspicion on people who are too interested in becoming a part of you, because what do you really want? You know. And if you look at Christian history, in the early days of Christianity, when we were, when it was illegal to be a Christian and when we were persecuted, while people talked about Jesus, if you wanted to actually come to become a Christian, if you wanted to be baptized, if you wanted to be a part of the community, there was a year-long process, and you had to have at least 2 people who were already Christians sponsor you. Say that you were okay, you weren't a spy for the government, you were a good person to let into the group. And we see the vestiges of that today in godparents. When you're baptized, you have to have someone sponsor you, right? That goes all the way back to, well, we need somebody to say that you're really okay before we really introduce you to too many people. Because...
I'm crying to this baby gonna come in.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, at that point it was mostly adults being baptized, but, you know, but the... we got to make sure you're not an FBI informant wearing a wire or the, you know, first century equivalent.
Question.
Go ahead.
What was it again? Diaspora?
Diaspora.
Was there an original diaspora when the nation broke up? When they got defeated, what was it, by the Babylonians?
Babylonians.
Was that considered also?
That was an exile. And they use different words for these things, but they're kind of the same. The Babylonian captivity, the Babylonian exile, is a separate thing from the diaspora.
Okay.
I think marriage has a lot to do with conversion to Judaism. Mm-hmm. I know several people, including ladies, who converted. Mm-hmm. And at one of our classes, you talked about the fact that the child would not necessarily be Jewish if the mother wasn't Jewish.
Yes.
Is there something about that that's true?
Yes. Judaism is a matrilineal religion. For the most conservative Jews today, if the mother isn't Jewish, the child isn't considered Jewish automatically. Now the child can convert, but they aren't automatically considered a part of the tribe. But if the mother is Jewish, then the child is automatically considered, and that goes way back into the ancient world when they didn't really understand as much about conception, and of course when science is in its infancy, you cannot say with certainty who has fathered any woman's child, but you can say with certainty who the mother of the child was, because there were witnesses.
More certain.
Right. So that goes all the way back. We can say with certainty that, but also remember that for much of the history of the nation of Israel, while there were periods when they were conquered, there were also periods when they were conquerors. And as part of that, they took captives, particularly women captives, and they didn't necessarily want the children of the foreign captives to be considered heirs or part of the tribe. So, and if you want an equivalence, look at American chattel slavery, right? It didn't matter who the father of the child was. If the mother was a slave, the child was a slave. You see similar patterns there. So it's not just unique to ancient Israel. We just happen to have more records of that because...
Aren't too many women plantation owners having affairs with...
Not so many, no. No. Not really.
It kind of seems to me that Jewish people are firmer in their faith than Christians. Do you think that's right?
Yes and no.
Okay.
And you've moved me right up to modern times. So let me talk about modern times a little bit. When you look at Judaism, just like Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, any of the faiths, there is a spectrum of belief. All right? And at one end of the spectrum, you have very, very conservative people. Hasidim, ultra-Orthodox. Then you move through the spectrum to Orthodox Judaism, conservative Judaism, reformed Judaism, and then at the other end of the spectrum you have what we call cultural Judaism. In the same way that we have cultural Christianity, there is cultural Judaism. People who would call themselves Jewish but only connect kind of tangentially with the faith. They might have had a bar mitzvah, for example, and they would have a chuppah at their wedding and break a glass at their wedding, but don't actually practice much of the faith, all the way down to people who are very, very extreme.
What did you call that?
Hasidim, Hasdim. Those are the ultra-Orthodox.
The men going to with the black
Yes, and the curls on the sides. So anywhere along the spectrum, you will find people. What's happening in Judaism is that there seems to be, at least in the West, and this is a little bit different in other parts of the world, but at least in the West, you see a migration to the ends of the spectrum. So either towards the cultural end of the spectrum or to the ultra-Orthodox end of the spectrum. What you see is a thinning out of the middle of the Reformed and somewhat of the conservative denominations. You see that kind of going down and people migrating to one end or the other. That's a really broad brush for a really complex series of sociological things, but it gives you a thumbnail. Now, let's talk a little bit about post-Holocaust, because that was a huge turning point in theology for Judaism, particularly in the theology of death and resurrection. Really, until the Holocaust, most Jewish people would say that that people who died and were buried and were waiting for the Messiah to come for the physical resurrection. All right, that was the belief post-Holocaust, and that you would be resurrected in the body you had at death. So if you had been if you had a leg amputated, you would be resurrected with your leg amputated. There's a cup. So what that came to be was they buried the bodies very quickly, right away, and didn't do any embalming or anything.
They still do that.
It depends on where in the spectrum you fall. And that if your body were in some way destroyed and not able to be buried, you wouldn't be resurrected. That was kind of mainstream Jewish theology until the Holocaust. Well, like every faith, theology changes as the circumstances in which the faith is practiced changed. And let me give you a Christian example, and then we'll talk about what happened in Judaism. Okay, the Christian example is baptism. Baptism used to be, in the first days of Christianity, I talked about a kind of difficult thing. It was kind of difficult to get baptized. You had to spend a whole year preparing for it. You had to have sponsors. It was mostly adults who were baptized. Your household, if you were a house leader, you might bring your household with you. And so if you had a child, your child could be baptized. But really, it was mostly adults. When Christianity came to be the legal religion of the empire, and particularly not just when it became legal, but when it became the religion of the Roman Empire, everybody wanted to be Christian. And people got baptized at birth, because their parents wanted them to be part of the faith you had to be if you wanted to hold any office in the empire. The theology that developed after that was that if you died without being baptized, you wouldn't go to heaven. All right? That was not a part of original Christian theology. It became part of Christian theology when baptism became very common. And so people then started baptizing their babies kind of right away. With the Reformation, when people looked back at the original documents of Christianity again, they said, hey, wait, Jesus didn't say anything about baptism being what gets you into the presence of God. It says something about faith getting you into the presence of God. So a lot of churches, particularly those that started around the time of the Reformation, began to do what they call believer's baptism, which is you couldn't be baptized until you had your own belief. So you wouldn't be baptized as an infant. You had to wait until you were old enough to state for yourself that you believed, and then you could be baptized. But there isn't a sense in that you go to hell if you're not baptized. The baptism is an expression of the faith. All right? As opposed to the denominations like us that hold on to infant baptism, where baptism is bringing you into the family of God and that you will develop faith.
Confirmation
takes the place of baptism, where you confirm the promises made on your behalf when you were baptized. All right? So, but that split in theology happened because of the progression of what was happening around the faith.
I always remember Archie Bunker saying he wasn't going to donate any organs because at the resurrection he wasn't going to go hunting around for the parts.
Who said that?
Archie Bunker. So this belief that you needed to be buried with everything that you wanted to have in resurrection, you saw in Catholicism. And it came from Judaism, right? So, get to the Holocaust. 6 million people whose bodies are gone. Mm-hmm. It is simply not acceptable to say that 6 million people were not going to be resurrection, that no member of the Jewish community could accept that. It was just not, you know, that kind of traumatic experience, that was just not something that meshed with their understanding of who God was, but also just as human beings, we can't accept that. So the theology morphed to say that while the resurrection will be bodily, and while it's important to preserve the body as much as possible, if it's not possible, God will make it work. And they landed very heavily on something that had always been a part of Jewish tradition, but that had been kind of secondary to the concept of the physical body, which is remembrance. And this had always been a part of that as long as you were remembered, as long as your name was spoken, that you could be resurrected, and that was a piece of it. And so they've landed now more heavily on that. Now, there had always been a tradition that you named your child after a beloved relative who had died, so that you would remember the person who had died. But that sense of as long as you are remembered, your spirit continues to exist, that was a part of Judaism from very early on, has really come to the fore in post-Holocaust. And if you go to any of the Holocaust museums or memorials, a big part of them are devoted to listing names and telling stories, but also listing names and making sure that they have all the names.
But they're just happy with the first initial, though, sometimes.
Yes, sometimes,
I don't understand that part of it. Yeah. You know, you don't have to name it after the whole name, just the initial.
Depends on where in the spectrum you fall. The more reformed you are, the more willing you are to go with something like, well, the first initial. The more conservative you are, the more it has to be the name.
Now, when a person dies, mm-hmm. do they believe the spirit joins the heavenly family or kingdom immediately?
Depends on where you fit in the spectrum. More conservative, dead is dead until the coming of the...
Including the spirit,
until the coming of the Messiah. As you move along the spectrum, the more reformed you are, the more the spirit waits in the presence of God until...
The physical body
joins
the spirit.
Yes.
Yeah. What do we believe?
Depends on where you fit.
where does this church?
Well, fit? Again, in the Episcopal Church, you find a variety of beliefs. Most Christians, including most Episcopalians, believe that immediately upon death, the spirit joins the presence of God. Some Christians believe, including me, that the resurrection to come will be physical in some way. Some Christians believe the resurrection will only be spiritual, that the kingdom of God will only be a spiritual kingdom.
Mm-hmm. So, you believe that the spirit joins the family of God immediately.
Right. And that eventually, that when Christ comes again, there will be some form of physical resurrection.
Okay.
I believe God, who created the heavens and the earth, doesn't need us to protect a physical body in order for there to be a physical resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How about the white light?
The what?
White light?
That people see?
Yeah.
Most people of faith would say that that is the presence of God
in
some
way. Light?
A lot of people who have had near-death experiences report seeing a white light.
Mm-hmm.
Not universally, but most people of faith would say that that is the presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And most people of any faith would say that that's the presence of God.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to walking through a door.
Mm-hmm.
And their concept of Messiah is?
Back to Judaism?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Messiah is God's anointed who will come and kind of like we talk about Christ coming again, will bring God's kingdom to earth.
And judgment.
And judgment, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let me talk a little bit, where am I on time? Let me talk a little bit about particular holidays and practices, and then we can talk a little bit about kind of spectrums. While the Passover is very important, it is actually not the principal holiday of Judaism. It's a major one, but the high holy days, the holiest of days, are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, which is Yomkippur.
Say that again.
Yomkippur. Is the Day of Atonement. Yom is day in Hebrew. So that's how you keep them track. Day of Atonement. And Rosh Hashanah is the new year, the beginning of the year. So atonement means what it means, making yourself right with God for the year to come. So the first celebration is Erev Yom Kippur, which is the eve of Yom Kippur, the day before. Let me back up. All Jewish holidays, celebrations, everything, the day runs from sundown to sundown. So when we talk about Sabbath, it starts Friday night and runs till Saturday night. Okay, and the Christian church has picked that up. That's why we do a Christmas Eve service and Easter vigil the evening before. The idea that the night before is part of. And this comes right from Genesis. If you read the creation stories, the way it says is, there was evening, there was morning, the first day. There was evening, there was morning, the second day. So it goes all the way back to the creation story, that the day begins at sundown and runs until sundown. All right?
When I was in school, there was a group of, we used the church on Sunday because it was owned and operated by Seventh-day Baptists.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't need it on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's an entirely different thing. Seventh-day Adventists and Seventh-day Baptist is a smaller sect, believe in celebrating Sabbath rather than the Lord's Day. Sunday is the Lord's Day. It's not the Sabbath. Sabbath is Saturday. Even Christians will tell you.
Yes.
Sabbath is Saturday. Sunday is the Lord's Day.
It's the resurrection.
Yes. And we know that because if you read the Gospels, Jesus was resurrected on the first day of the week. Right? Not the seventh day. The first day of the week. So, where was I? Yom Kippur. So Erev Yom Kippur, which is the day before Yom Kippur, you make yourself one, you make amends with people that you have sinned against in the prior year. On Yom Kippur, you make amends with God for the sins you have committed the prior year. These are days of fasting, of prayer, of repentance. For many Jews, it is the only time that they go to synagogue.
Isn't there something about 8 days?
The 8 days between Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. The Day of Atonement begins the process of that. So, and for, like I said, for many Jews, it's the only times they go to synagogue are Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. And so a lot of synagogues have this huge seating capacity, but the way that you get tickets for some of them to the High Holy Day services is by paying your membership dues to the temple. And if you don't pay your membership dues, you don't get High Holy Day tickets. That's...
And this takes place in December, right?
Like, no, the fall.
Oh, okay. What date?
It depends. It's
based on
lunar calendar,
like our Easter is.
Yes. So it moves up somewhere between mid-September and mid-October.
Oh, okay.
Have you thought about saying if you don't pay then you can't have Christmas and Easter?
It doesn't work as well for us because So Yom Kippur is a fast day, and then the days between Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah are to complete the process of making amends. And then the new year begins with the Rosh Hashanah celebrations, and you basically start with a clean slate with the new year. Right? Those are the high holy days. That's a very rough description, but kind of gives you a sense. So that's the most important principal feasts. The second is Passover. All right, and we're heading up to Passover now. Passover and Easter often coincide, except that the Christian calendar of finding Easter, while both are based on the lunar calendar, the Christian way of calculating the date of Easter has a fixed date that it calculates from, and the Jewish way of calculating the Passover dates doesn't. So they're sometimes further apart than others. But it's a similar springtime, right around the spring equinox.
Isn't there something about the oil and the lamps lasted much longer?
That's not Passover, that's Hanukkah.
Oh.
So, and that's a very minor feast. I'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
So Passover is the other major feast. Passover remembers the passing over of the angel of death, when the angel of death passed over the people of Israel but killed the firstborn sons of the Egyptians, that led to their freedom from slavery in Egypt. And Passover is actually a week long, but the first Passover meal is the major one, the one that families try to gather for. And then there may be several other different Passover meals throughout the week with different groups of people. The Passover meal revolves around the telling of the story of slavery in Egypt, and we've talked a little bit about this. It features roasted meat, but also some ritual pieces to the meal. And during the course of the meal, you tell the story of, or the father generally tells the story, sometimes the mother, depending again where you are on the conservative to reformed spectrum, tells the story of the escape of the people from Egypt in a very ritual way with some ritual questions. And it ends with, just like it always has as far back in history, with breaking unleavened bread and blessing a cup of wine that is shared by everybody. And that's the place that we get our communion practice from, because that's what Jesus did with his disciples at the Last Supper.
Mm-hmm. Was, that was your Passover.
That was the Passover meal.
Meal.
Mm-hmm. So it ended with breaking the bread and blessing the cup, and that's the story we tell in our Eucharist. Now, remember I said this is very home-based, so Passover, while many people will go to synagogue to pray or to worship during the Passover time, that's not as important as the meal in the family home where you're supposed to invite people. So you're supposed to particularly invite people who would maybe be having it alone. So not just your family, but everybody. And one of the customs that is part of the modern day Seder is that you always leave a seat empty. And the story is that the seat is empty for the prophet Elijah, who must come before the Messiah comes. And part of the ritual is sending a child to open the door and let Elijah in if he's there. But you always have an empty... But the tradition is you always include people at your Passover table, and you always have an empty seat so you can include one more. So that's a piece of it. Now, where you fall on the spectrum of Judaism from conservative to reformed dictates how strictly you keep the rules around Passover. Remember that as the people were fleeing Egypt, they were told to not make leavened bread because they didn't have time for it to rise. So they made unleavened bread, that is bread with no yeast. So somewhere along the way, it came to be not just that the bread that you do with the Passover should not have yeast, but that nothing you eat during Passover should have yeast. So when something is called kosher for Passover, that means not only does it meet the regular ways of the regular definition of kosher, but it also has no yeast or gluten in it. No. If you think about all of the things that might have yeast in them, some wines have yeast in it. Well, if you're very conservative, that's not kosher for Passover. Lots of different things have yeast or gluten in them.
What part of the spectrum are the Jewish people that change dishes? And
very, 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 very conservative people have dishes that they use just for Passover, so that there isn't any chance of anything remaining on the dishes. And those people will clean, part of Passover is cleaning your house. Now, if you're on the reformed end, you're cleaning your house because you're having a dinner party. So they clean their house. If you're on the conservative end, you clean the house to remove every single trace of yeast. And that includes shaking your books to make sure that crumbs are out of them. And removing anything with yeast from your home. As you move along the more reformed, you get to people who just put the things with yeast in them away and don't eat them during Passover, down to, oh, well, we just don't eat leavened bread at the Seder. And all of those are in the spectrum of practice. But at the far end of the spectrum is we have special dishes and pots for Passover, so that there is no possibility of any particle of...
Is this the meal where there's not supposed to be anything left over? Or is it just
yes,
the
you're not supposed to have anything left over because, again, because they were supposed to be ready to go, right? Eat the meal quickly because the angel of death's going to pass over and Pharaoh's going to let you go and you need to be ready to go. So don't have leftovers that you have to deal with. Eat it all. And that still is part of the tradition. One of the concepts in modern Judaism, more than modern, but in Judaism, is the idea of fencing the Torah. And I've talked about this here before. There are commandments that God gave, and then there are ways to make sure that you don't violate them even by mistake. And the more conservative you are, the more fences you build. So, for example, I'll take one that that people are maybe more familiar with. one of the commands in Jewish law, in the law that came from God, is don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Excuse me. So, if you are, if you're cooking, you don't take the milk from a goat and boil the child in the mother's milk. That's the actual text of the command. Don't boil a kid in its mother's milk. Well, particularly once you get a few more goats, how do you really know?
Who's the mother of
this particular
child?
Or, you know, where this milk came from? And so the fence was, well, don't cook meat and milk together. Then you're sure that you don't, by accident, mix, you know, boil the kid in its mother's milk. Okay, well, let's go another fence and say, don't eat meat and milk in the same meal. Then you can be really sure that you're not. Mm-hmm. Well, then let's go another step and say, let's just make sure we have separate dishes for meat meals and milk meals, dairy meals and meat meals. That way we can be really, really sure that we don't accidentally mix even a little bit. Well, let's, in addition to have separate dishes, let's have separate refrigerators, and we'll keep the milk in one and the meat in one, and let's even have separate kitchens, have separate stoves. And so the kind of cultural Judaism is don't boil a kid in its mother's milk, but a cheeseburger's fine because the chances that that processed cheese food, you know, came from that cow's mother is not worth worrying about, all the way to let's have separate kitchens for meat meals and milk meals.
Who has the right to institute these fences?
Depends on which flavor of Jew you are. Generally, a rabbi or a council of rabbis. And this is the way that Jewish law gets done, is you bring a question to a rabbi, and the rabbi looks at all of the writings of what has been said about this way down through the past and gives you an answer. Mm-hmm.
So all of these fences that have been built through the thousands of years are still in effect?
Depends on, again, where you're in the spectrum.
Yeah, if you're more Orthodox.
Right.
What was the original reason for not boiling it? I mean, was it just a... It would not be a nice thing to do. Was it a health reason?
No, it's most of the laws are God moving the people towards more. Remember, God's always moving us towards more justice, more equity, more in that direction. So you think about the nations around Israel. You're talking about people who. You're talking about people who, in many cases, still are doing human sacrifice, right? So God's commands to his people are, well, that human sacrifice thing is right out. We're doing animal sacrifices, which was a huge step in the movement towards justice and inclusion. But beyond that, I want you to go one step further and think about the animal. That's also the root of kosher. When we talk about kosher, it has to do with the way that the animal is killed and what is done with the blood, because in Hebrew, blood and life are connected. The words for blood and life are very closely connected even. And so the concept is that the life of the animal lives in its blood, and so that you have to kill the animal in a way that preserves its blood, and you have to deal with the blood respectfully, and you don't eat the blood. That's part of the reason that when Jesus said, this wine is my blood, I want you to drink it, that was really pretty scandalous.
Mm-hmm. Because he's talking about his life.
Right, my life. Mm-hmm. And because Jewish people don't drink blood. They don't eat blood. That's part of what makes meat kosher, is that it's the blood is drained from it and disposed of respectfully.
I have my friends who make blood soup just to make it. And the Scots make blood pudding and all that stuff.
I can't answer that because...
I mean, the most, you know, faithful Catholic Christians, they make blood soup.
Well, Catholics never held that. Yeah. That idea of blood being sacred, while you always were to refrain from human blood, that idea that the blood of the animal carried its life did not make the transition from Judaism to Christianity. So, you would not find a lot of people who consider themselves practicing Jews who would make blood soup.
Janina.
Yeah. So you get the idea of how this works. And again, long... let me talk a little bit...
Is this still ongoing?
Oh, yes.
In our technical world, you would imagine that fences are still required.
No, they're still required.
Yeah. Okay.
And even more so because we know about molecules and things.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
So part of the concern is we don't want any molecule of...
Well, the supermarket is filled with shells of kosher food.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let me talk a little bit about a couple of other minor holidays. There's a fall holiday called Sukkot.
How do you spell it?
The spelling's a little weird because Hebrew doesn't transliterate exactly mm-hmm. into English, but Sukkot is as common as any of it. That's a harvest festival, but it's also called the Festival of the Booths.
And of the what?
Booths, B-O-O-T-H, booths. And again, as you get more into the conservative spectrum, people will build structures, basically outdoor booths, and somewhere from take their meals out there during the week to sleep out there. And this comes from a festival that was commanded in the Torah to honor the harvest, and you made some sacrifices and you lived outdoors.
People said, oh, let's build a booth for with it.
Yes, booths and lodges. That's kind of where it comes from, is to remember the blessings of God. So that's the fall one. The one you've probably heard of is Hanukkah, which is a later festival. And it comes from a time when a group of Jewish people called the Maccabees, who were standing up against an invader, had enough oil for just one day, and because of the intervention of God, their lamps burned for 7 days. And so that's what the menorah comes from, right? The seven-branched candelabra. That there was enough light, there was enough fuel for one day, but it burned for seven, so it's a festival of light. Hanukkah is a really minor Jewish feast. It's one of the last ones that got added to the Jewish calendar, and it involves things around oil. So they fry potato pancakes because you fry them in oil.
And this is the one near Christmas.
Near Christmas, yeah. Right. Okay. It really only became anything at all as the Christian church, Christmas became a major feast for us.
And all the kids wanted a feast or
festival. Exactly. Right. And so while Christmas is kind of our second major feast now, Easter's our first, Christmas is our second.
The kids would say Halloween is first.
Well, yes, but the kids are wrong. Halloween is hardly even Christian. But it's just something we stole from the pagans.
Yeah.
Well, we stole Christmas from the pagans,
too. I'm just saying, all these parties and costumes. And
right. But as Christians, Easter, our first festival, Christmas, our second, only as Christmas became a really big cultural deal did Hanukkah begin to become important. And really observant Jews today will tell you that Hanukkah really, it's not the Jewish Christmas. It's just, mm-hmm. you know, almost every faith has a festival relating to light during winter, at midwinter, and they're no exception.
And a harvest one.
And a harvest one. And then the other kind of minor feast that anyone who calls themselves a Jew would at least be familiar with is Purim,
How do you spell it?
P-U-R-I-M. And Purim comes from the story of Esther. It remembers the story of Esther, where, if you remember the story, Esther is a secret Jew who becomes queen of a nation and saves her people from one of the king's evil henchmen. And the Purim celebrations involve telling the story of Esther and a costume. All the kids dress up in costume. It used to be they dressed up in costumes just from Esther, but now they dress up in any costume they want. And you tell the story of Esther. But also you make cookies that are three-sided because the hat that the evil person wore in the story was supposedly three-sided. But you have lots of sweets. So the cookies are always filled with sweet fruit, and you make chocolates and those kinds of things. And the idea is that also you are to take, I forget the Hebrew word, but you're to take collections of sweets to people who live around you, and you're supposed to do it anonymously. So, and often these days they go in glass jars, like glass mason jars, so you'll run around leaving jars of sweets on people's... it's kind of a reverse Halloween. Rather than going out and getting sweets, you're supposed to take sweets to people. But of course, you come home and your porch is full of
I tried sweets making them as well. One time, yes. Very unsuccessfully.
Yes, they're a very complicated cookie to make.
Very heavy.
Yes, and they're not supposed to be. They're supposed to be light. So, but these, again, you know, just like our kind of minor festivals, there are minor festivals in Judaism, but unlike our minor festivals that mostly take place in the church, their minor festivals mostly take place in the home and in the community, because that, again, focus became the home rather than...
Do they have a hierarchy in terms of their religious church organization, like ours? Do I mean, like, the rabbi, where does he fit? What would he be, a priest,
it doesn't quite work like that.
Okay.
Each congregation is, even in the most conservative, is somewhat autonomous, but there are also accrediting bodies for rabbis in the different within the different kind of branches. So the Reformed folk have their own accrediting bodies for rabbis, and sometimes their own yeshivas, religious schools. Conservative Jews have their own bodies. The Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox all have their own bodies. But there's, and just like in Christianity, there's some mutual acknowledgement in the same way that we are in full communion with the Evangelical Lutheran Church. So we believe that their pastors are interchangeable with our priests. The Reformed and the Conservative tend to have some of that, but the ultra-Orthodox and the Orthodox don't. So it's a more complicated question
but
than
they
that.
They do have women rabbis.
Some of them, yeah. The Reformed and even some Conservative synagogues now.
Now, are rabbis leaders of a church?
Yes.
Or are they just learned people who can teach and do other things?
Both.
Okay.
Not every rabbi leads a congregation, not every rabbi leads a congregation, but almost everybody who leads a congregation is a rabbi. But in a lot of ways, the rabbis are not supposed to be administrators. So mm-hmm. often synagogues have an administrator who runs the building and deals mm-hmm. with all that stuff, and the rabbi is the teacher.
Yes.
But then in other places, the rabbis, and not all rabbis are employed by the synagogue. Mm-hmm. So it's...
Yes, okay.
It varies a lot depending on...
Are there other religious positions that have names like rabbi?
Almost every synagogue has a cantor, the person who leads
the singing.
In the more conservative you are, the more likely it is that your cantor will have to be a Jew and some kind of educated Jew. The more reformed you are, the more likely it is that the cantor is just a hired singer.
Okay.
So,
They do revere studying.
Studying is,
Torah,
is yeah.
Particularly for, well, for yes. Maybe it's changed, but mm-hmm. It was for men.
Oh, especially for men, yes.
Did you ever read a book called The Bread Givers?
Yes.
Yeah. The what?
The Bread Givers. It's about a family, and you know, father doesn't have to do anything as long as he sits and studies the Torah.
Yes.
Women do all the work.
Yes. And as you get more conservative, the ideal is that every man will study the Torah as much as possible. And so mm-hmm. you try to get yourself to a place where...
Is there any tradition that in every family, like the oldest male will become a rabbi? Like there used to be some... Okay.
No. Although if your father is a rabbi, the expectation is that you will follow in his footsteps okay. in the more conservative mm-hmm. branches. And there's always a high value on study. The bat mitzvah is for girls, bar mitzvah for boys. Again, more conservative wouldn't do a bat mitzvah at all. 13 is the age of adulthood. But in order, and what it means is called to the Torah. That's what you're done. You have to learn a passage of Torah that you can chant by heart. Again, the more conservative you are, the more requirements, the less conservative you are, the fewer requirements for that. But the expectation is that certainly all male children, and these days most children of anyone who's observant, will learn to read Hebrew at least enough to be able to do their Torah passage.
Would you spend just a minute going back to the Passover and mm-hmm. Jesus and the blood? Mm-hmm. I kind of
missed that a little bit.
Yeah.
The heart of kosher, of Jewish dietary laws, all right, is the way the animal is killed and the way the blood is disposed of. That's kind of the central pillar of kosher. Because in Jewish belief, the blood represents the life of the animal. The blood carries the life of the animal. So from the very earliest days, and in the command in the Old Testament, the people of God do not consume blood. All right?
Any blood.
But how could a conservative person today eat a raw steak?
They don't.
Okay.
So that's... That's one of the central pillars, right, of Judaism. The people of God do not consume blood. Period. End of sentence. So, and that's how you know a meat is able to be eaten, because it was killed correctly and the blood was disposed of respectfully.
All right? And the meat is cooked properly?
And the meat is cooked properly.
Okay.
Yes. But kosher has to do with...
Yeah.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
So... We get to the Passover meal, where we're remembering, right, all of the mighty works that God has done in the past. And Jesus is sitting with his disciples, and he picks up the cup of wine that is the very last piece of the Passover meal. And he says, take this, all of you. Remember that everybody around that table is a Jew. Take this, all of you, and drink it. This is my blood, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. So now you're a Jewish person who your entire life you've been told the people of God do not consume blood. And here's Jesus saying, this is my blood, which is given for you. Drink it in remembrance of me.
More radical can you get?
Yes. It is exceedingly radical. And what it's saying is, those things that God commanded are now different. And there's nothing more could strike at the heart of God's doing a new thing in a new way, and you may need to reconsider what it means to follow God than to be told, you're going to drink my blood as a Jewish person. Okay? So.
And the idea of consuming somebody's body, like in mm-hmm, the bread, that mm-hmm. would probably be very radical also.
Radical too. But the blood was
more
the
so.
Really,
yeah,
more so.
More so.
I mean, eating human flesh, of course, was abhorrent
yes.
to everyone. But, mm-hmm. but the blood thing was particular too. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know.
I have to excuse myself.
Yes,
I have a meeting.
Uh-huh.
I gotta go.
Thank you.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
See you
next week. Next week we'll be looking at Islam, particularly modern day practices. So, all right. So that's kind of a very rough and ready version of overview of modern Judaism.
And why do they wear the little
the hats?
The little tiny cap, black cap.
Well, it comes from the idea that we are all under God's sight all the time, and so covering your head is to show your acceptance, that your acknowledgement that you are always in mm-hmm. God's sight. Mm-hmm. And so women cover their heads. Women covering their heads is kind of in every religion.
I know, yes.
Yes. but in Judaism, men also mm-hmm. cover their heads because they are under the sight of God. And so they want to be respectful of that. And mm-hmm. so the yarmulke is a way to, developed in the 1800s, as a way for men to have their heads covered mm-hmm. without it being so radically different from the world around them.
Yeah.
Which is the answer for a lot of practices, is mm-hmm. we want to keep our tradition, but we have to live in the world. So so again, even today, the bigger the hat that you see the man wearing, the more likely he is to be on the conservative end of the spectrum, the more conservative mm-hmm. end of the spectrum he is.
Would they take their hats off in the church or in the synagogue?
No. Oh, okay. You cover your head all the time.
Okay.
I'm amazed that they stay on. Hmm. I just have visions of them sliding off.
So, and women also cover their heads. Men stop covering their heads earlier in as you move towards the reform spectrum than the women do, but which is really also really pretty typical. No, I think that's kind of gives you the overview. So, next week we'll talk about Islam. And then we're going to take the week after Easter off. So, and I have three more to do. And then we can talk about what we want to do in
next.
The fall.
Okay.
So,
I used to think